I'm speaking as a Marxist and therefore as a convinced atheist. I believe that human beings are capable of changing the world with no need for any God or spirit to help them on the way. Philosophically, Marxists are materialists, not in the sense that the average citizen person would use that word in the sense of attached to worldly goods, but materialists in the sense that we believe only in the material world that exists, and not as, I mean, Lenin was in polemicizing in 1908 in his book on Dialectical Materialism and Empirical Criticism, refers to Bishop Berkeley in 1710, who raised the idea that it's thought that gives existence to matter. And, of course, the idea is that the table here exists because we give it existence by thinking about it, and once we leave the room, it stops existing. And, of course, that would have been ridiculous to anybody. At the end of the story, is resolved by the fact that the highest form of thought, the spirit of God, is what gives creation to everything. So we exist thanks to his thinking about us. Now, we reject that kind of outlook and say what the only real thing is the material world that we have. Now, there are many Christians, not all of them, of course, who, well, obviously believing in God, also contribute to attempting to change this world that we live in. And they do a lot of charitable work, and a lot of them are self-sacrificing and are not materialist in the sense that the average person would use, in the sense that they're not attached to the worldly goods and do attempt to do good in the world. But as institutions, the church or the various churches, we believe, do serve the interests of a class in society, a dominant class in society, and which would, I believe, probably contradicts the spirit of many of the people who adhere to the church. Now, I don't have lots of time, but I'm going to refer to two aspects. One is the God of the Old Testament, and as a good Catholic boy, this is my Bible from school. It's the Revised Standard Version of the Catholic edition.
Very good.
And this summer, I actually spent some time reading my Italian version. Unfortunately, I didn't bring it with me because I underlined Leviticus because I thought it was wonderful reading. Mm. It's a terrible book, of course, because it's full of awful stuff that we have to do to people. But just to give it, I mean, if the idea is that Christianity and the book that it's based on, the Bible, right from the early days, is based on a God, a good, a merciful, a forgiving God, etc., well, the Old Testament doesn't fit that. I mean, it's clearly sexist, it's anti-homosexual, it's all kinds of stuff. Just one example in Leviticus 12, you know. If a woman has given birth to a male child, then she'll be unclean for 7 days. If she gives birth to a female child, she's unclean for 2 weeks. So if you have a girl, then the uncleanliness is stronger, which shows that the God of the Old Testament was clearly male chauvinist. If you read through other parts of Leviticus, adulterers should be put to death. But if a man commits adultery with a slave, then they're not put to death because the woman, being a slave, is not such a serious sin. And on homosexuality, of course, they should be put to death. That you just read the whole of Leviticus, and you'll see that it is a wonderful read. It makes a terrifying read, actually. If you go to Deuteronomy, you find a God who supports his people in war. And I'll just give you an example. He says, when you draw near to a city, he's talking to the Jews, to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. Sounds good at the beginning. And if its answer to you is peace, and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. So if they surrender, you make them slaves. But if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. And it goes on. And you shall put all its males to the sword. Therefore you kill all the males. And I won't read the whole thing. Then he goes on to say that if you've defeated this people, who fought a war probably because they knew that if they surrendered they'd be your slaves, so I could understand why they would fight a war to stop you enslaving them, but because they fought you, and as God was on the side of the Jews, he helped them to defeat these people. These people were in a pretty bad state. Now, it says later on, if you found, I won't read the quote here, you can come and look for it, I want to be quick, but if you find a woman that's pleasing to you amongst the prisoners, give her a month to mourn the dead. That's probably because he just killed her brothers, her father, I don't know who else, her uncles, possibly sons if she had any. And you find her pleasing, you can take her as your wife, and then afterwards, if you don't like her, you can send her away. The only thing you can't do to her is make her a slave because you humiliated her. Now, this is the God of the Old Testament. This is the God of an ancient people, like all gods of the ancient peoples, who were called on by the ancient peoples to side with them in giving them some kind of magic power over their enemies in fighting wars. We have no problem with studying that, but the problem I would have is adopting it as a form of belief then guides me in my life thereafter. But it's not strange. I mean, I think the German soldiers had God is with us on their belts, the Christian God, and the people on the other side probably thought God was on their side too. And many wars have been fought in the name of God. In Northern Ireland we have a conflict between Christians, not even between Muslims and Christians, but Christians of the Protestant and Catholic variety. In reality, these conflicts express themselves through as religious conflicts. In reality, they express material interests of different groups in society, and in particular, classes. But if we go to Christianity of the New Testament, which a lot of the stuff in the New Testament would contradict, you know, the famous eye for an eye, and then it's no, turn the other cheek. There are contradictions there, but if you actually look at the origins of the Christians, you'll find there's a book actually being sold, a new edition. This is my old edition, Foundations of Christianity. And just to give you an idea, that I first read this book when I was 17, and I was a Catholic and I believed in God, so I don't think I read it thinking this is going to tell the truth and this is a lie. I actually read these two together and I thought, I'm not going to take anything he says for granted. Every quote he provided, I went and looked it up in the Bible, and as I read, I found that everything he quoted was actually there. It was in the Bible and it made sense. Just one little example for which I found interesting. Luke says, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you that hunger now, for ye shall be satisfied." Now that's clearly an indication that it's the poor who will be rewarded, and the rich cannot be rewarded. The rich cannot, in fact, the rich man can't even get through, you know, through the eye. It's easy. The famous quote about the camel and the eye and the needle. In Matthew, you find a different version, which is, if I can find it, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." That's justice. Now, you see, the Matthew version allows you to be rich, but poor in spirit, and thirsting for justice, but be rich. Whereas the Luke version is quite clear, if you're poor, you'll be rewarded, not if you're poor in spirit. Now there is a fundamental difference between the two terms. Now Kautsky points out that where do these changes come about? Why is there a slightly different version within the different Gospels? Well, they were written at slightly different times. Christianity, to begin with, I was going to quote at length, but I don't have that much time. The point that Kautsky makes is that the early Christian communities were they were spread, obviously, they were a Jewish sect, and throughout the Roman Empire there were Jewish communities. From that they spread beyond the Jewish community, and originally they recruited from the most downtrodden layers of society, the slaves, the poor, etc. And they were actually, he quotes examples where they used to mock the Christians for being that layer of society, incapable of recruiting wealthy, educated people who stuck to their previous pagan beliefs. But he points out that if you know the Luke version of the gospel is really that poor layer speaking with vengeance against the rich, you know, you will be condemned, not us, the poor. We're the ones who are going to inherit the world that God has created at some point. Later on it was changed. Now, in the early days of the Christian church, as I said, it was limited to a minority of a poor layer of society. But as the Roman Empire entered into crisis, like all class societies that enter periods of crisis, we have it today, actually. You have the Jehovah's Witnesses who go around knocking on doors and telling you that, you know, you'll see your dead children one day and all this kind of stuff. And they prey on what I consider to be unfortunate people who have had some problem in their life, and they promise them all kinds of stuff. And you have these newborn again Christians and all kinds of new churches developing in a period in which society today is in crisis. There's a serious crisis of the capitalist system, and some people, if you remember in the year 2000, the end of the world is nigh and all this kind of stuff, that's been many times. When society is in crisis, the idea that the world is going to end, the world is not going to end. What is going to end is a particular form of society which is in crisis. And within the Roman society, even at a certain point, even amongst the higher layers, the wealthier layers, a desire for something better than the world, the degenerate world in which they lived, as the Roman Empire sank deeper and deeper into the morass. And at a certain point, they started to recruit wealthier Romans. And at that point, the idea that the poor only can be part of the Christian community, or they only can inherit the future world, becomes a problem, because these are wealthy people. So the Matthew version actually is an attempt to revise slightly the text and adapt it to the new influx of the wealthy. The wealthy also played a useful role, because the early Christians did have a communist outlook on life. Equality, sharing out the goods, a community spirit of these groups. And it was a kind of primitive communism that was there, but the problem that Kautsky points out, it was a communism of consumption and not a communism of production. And the problem is, you can consume in a communist way wealth, but somebody has to produce it. In Roman times, that wealth was produced on the basis of slave labour, and the wealthy had this wealth. If you recruited a wealthy Roman into the Christian community, he brought with him all his worldly goods. And if you managed to get him to believe that he had to share it with everybody, it allowed the early Christian communities to develop, to survive and develop. But that meant the more that developed, the more you need to recruit wealthy people to share out these goods. And there's a limit to how far you can go with that. But it explains changes in the story. I mean, Kautsky actually gives very interesting references. For example, the figure of Pontius Pilate, who is presented as a man who washes his hands of condemning Jesus. Well, Pontius Pilate was a Roman. It's most like it. Pontius Pilate, the actual Roman records of Pontius Pilate, is that he had to be withdrawn as governor, because he was such a ruthless governor. He was so oppressive that he was actually fomenting rebellions amongst the Jews. And these are people who were oppressed by an empire. It's normal that people don't want to be oppressed by a foreign imperialist power. And there were rebellious forces amongst them. But Pontius Pilate in the Gospel version appears almost as a good man. He washes his hands of this thing. He crucified so many Jews that he wouldn't have had a problem crucifying one more. But the story has changed in such a way that it's no longer the Romans who are to blame. All the Romans did was they asked the rabble, who were Jews, what do you want to do? And it was the Jews who had Jesus crucified. And therefore, then, as you recruited more and more Romans, we have no problems with Romans. You didn't do anything to Jesus. Those terrible Jews. And that's been used ever since against the Jewish people. It would seem illogical to me that Jewish people would want somebody who, I mean, I'm not going to go into the details, may have led or not led poor people in revolts against the empire, and they say, no, we want our leader to be crucified and release the thief. It would have been most likely the way around. You've got to remember that the Gospels were written long after the events took place. And the stories, if you consider that the Christian community developed amongst the poorest layers, they would have been, in likelihood, mostly illiterate, and it would have been word of mouth. Now consider it, a lot of the Gospels were written in the second century, different moment, second and third century. They weren't written in 33 AD. They were written down later on, stories passed down from one to another. And the versions that we've received can't be considered as historical records of fact. And they were handwritten and hand-copied from generation to generation. And the versions that survive end up being the versions that fit the dominant idea within a church, which by at a certain point, the church is no longer the church of the oppressed, of the poor, but becomes the official church of the state. And it transforms itself from the original communist, in the sense of the idea of sharing and equality, into an instrument of an oppressive state over the people. And the idea that goes with it is, you accept your lot today because you will be rewarded when you die. Then justice will be made, will be done, and the poor, as I say, they will inherit, etc. But while you're alive, this gives you the idea that my oppression now, I can live with it because I know that one day justice will be done. And it's a very useful idea if you can use it and inculcate it into millions of people, because it gives you the idea that nothing can be done really to change this world, because this world is dominated by men and women. And it's not God that rules this world. He's given us the free will to do what we want in this world, and we make a terrible mess of it. But once we die, God will do justice. Now, that's useful in making people think that the struggle is not join a union and strike for better wages. It's not build a party and overthrow the government that's oppressing you and change society. Or things like, for example, the food crisis that we have at the moment. Is it about not enough food and too many people? Well, I'd invite you to read our website last week. We published an article. Figures from The Guardian. It's not a Marxist plot or we're inventing the figures. The Guardian showed quite clearly that there's been no fall in overall food production. In fact, 2007 was a bumper harvest. The problem in places like Haiti is not that there's not enough food. It's that they used to produce 95% of the rice they consumed. And then America in particular, but the IMF imposed on Haiti policies which said you must reduce tariffs on imported food, which meant that the food from abroad would be able to compete with the local produce. They reduced the tariffs, of course, because they needed the loan, otherwise they wouldn't get the loan. The result was they destroyed the local farming in Haiti. Now Haiti imports 75% of its rice, mostly from the United States. A nice little system to increase the profits of the American agro-industry. That's got nothing to do with natural calamities. It's to do with the class society we live in. Remove imperialism and the profit motive that dominates, motivates capitalism, and you can, in actual sense, return to the original, in this I would agree, the original Christians who said we should share the wealth between the people, but on a much higher level. Not the wealth, the limited wealth, even of the Roman Empire, but a wealth which today would have been unimaginable in those days. They've actually increased the amount of food produced in the world since the 60s per inhabitant of the planet. In the 60s, a UN report showed that the world was producing an average of 2,300 calories per head in the world, and in the 90s, it was 2,700 calories. Food production has been growing faster than the population growth. You wouldn't believe that if you read the mainstream media and the general ideas they give you. The problem is one of distribution. Now, that problem can be solved simply by changing society. Removing capitalism, removing the profit motive, and saying the resources that are being produced by the mass of working people should be controlled by the people that produce those resources and shared out equally. I believe, we as Marxists believe, that if you achieve that, then the need for a God or the belief in a God will gradually disappear. Because in reality, for many people, God is actually an escape from this terrible world that we live in. Now, the difference here is that my friend here, Peter, clearly believes that God has a role, otherwise he wouldn't be dressed the way he's dressed. And on many things we could probably agree about the terrible things that happen in the world. I think it's the way to solve these problems which I think we would differ on. But I'll leave it there, and then you can ask questions and Peter can make his points.
Thank you very much.